Chapter 10, Breaking the Bread Cartel. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Ecclesiasticus chapter 11, verse 1. Acting judges in South African high courts are an endangered species. They are usually drawn from the ranks of seasoned practitioners and senior magistrates, with a sprinkling of legal academics, and are required to do the heavy lifting in the division in which they are appointed. Cynics often observe that accepting an acting appointment is an act of insolvency for senior practitioners, as their incomes from their practices usually far exceed the stipends paid to acting judges. In theory, acting judges take the place of a permanent judge who is on long leave, absent on business, such as a commission of inquiry, or ill. In practice, the less attractive trials, the appeals with long records, and the bulkier paper-based motion cases, especially those wrapped in legal arguments made of razor wire, are allocated to acting judges in disproportionate dollops. Judges president regard this practice as a baptism of fire or, in some instances, aversion therapy designed to put the hapless acting judges off a career on the bench for all time. While many acting judges take up their appointments as a duty call in the sense of paying back the system for the privileges it has bestowed on them, most have to be cajoled into acting, even though a stint on the bench amounts to a nice break from the hurdy-burdy of legal practice. In November 2010, Francois von Sail SC, a senior and respected member of the Cape Bar, was serving as an acting judge in his home division. A former Attorney General in the homeland of Transkei, with a background in the prosecution service of the old South Africa, he found himself on the bench for a spell doing his civic duty in the motion court set aside for unopposed and urgent matters. The Western Cape Division of the High Court, or Western Cape High Court for short, has a refined view of what's urgent and what isn't. As a result, it has developed the notion of semi-urgency for the purpose of giving deserving litigants an accelerated hearing in a way that does not unduly prejudice those waiting their turn on the ordinary court rolls. As one of the duty judges of the week, Acting Judge von Sail found himself at the receiving end of two complex and novel applications that were alleged to be urgent, not just semi-urgent, because the applicant said the claims were on the point of becoming prescribed. The cases had to be heard and an order given in a matter of days. To his credit, Acting Judge von Sail heard the cases and made his orders within the time frame desired. This is hardly the optimum situation for an acting judge to find himself in, especially in circumstances in which all three respondents in the cases opposed the granting of relief with might and main, using large teams of experienced lawyers. The facts were relatively simple. Three bread producers, Pioneer Foods, Tiger Consumer Brands, and Premier Foods had put their heads together to collude in three ways. First, they agreed to fix their bread price increases. Second, they reduced the commissions payable to their respective distributors. And third, they agreed not to poach distributors from each other. This is classically how a cartel operates. As in many other countries, it is illegal to operate a cartel in South Africa. This one was swiftly reported to the Competition Commission by anguished bread distributors who found themselves with less commission for the same work. The commission duly investigated the matter and fined the participants heavily for their respective roles in the cartel, once its workings had been exposed with the help of the whistleblowers. This finding of cartel activity put consumers of bread and the distributors employed by the three bread manufacturers in a position to sue for damages. The novelty of the matter was that the applicants in the two cases, one on behalf of consumers and the other on behalf of distributors, wanted to have a class action certified in each case, something that had not been done before in South Africa. Initially, the bread distributors, led by a doughty bread distributor and community activist called Imran Mukaddam, sought the advice of Charles Abrams, a Cape-based attorney specializing in public interest litigation. They were about 100 in number and had stories to tell in relation to the adverse and in some cases fatal impact of the cartel on their businesses. It soon became apparent from the antecedent proceedings in the Competition Tribunal that the largest loss had been borne by consumers of bread sold at cartel prices. As a result, Mukaddam and his team decided to attempt a class action for the hard-pressed consumers of bread as well. The Children's Resources Centre, a charitable trust, expressed interest in the matter and joined the fray as an applicant. The Constitution does contemplate a procedure of the kind pressed before acting Judge von Sail for infringements or threatened infringements of a right in the Bill of Rights. Such a situation, anyone acting as a member of or in the interests of a group or class of people may approach a competent court for appropriate relief. In 1998, the South African Law Reform Commission recommended to government that legislation be passed to facilitate class actions in South Africa. Seeing this proposed legislation as a potential rod for its own chastisement, the government shelved the draft bill and left it to the courts to work out how best to deal with the class action suits so beloved of American jurisprudence. This challenge was taken up in the case entitled Permanent Secretary, Department of Welfare, Eastern Cape Provincial Government versus Nkluza and others in 2001. In 1997, the Eastern Cape Provincial Government decided to deal with the problem of ghost pensioners by suspending various social grants, including disability grants, and requiring bona fide beneficiaries to reapply. However, the province lacked the resources to administer this process, leading to lengthy delays in restoring the benefits of many poor and disadvantaged people. Eventually, the Legal Resources Centre decided to institute a class action via M.N. Nkluza and others on behalf of all recipients of disability grants in the province. In a judgment handed down in Eastern Cape High Court in 2001, Judge Johan Froneman, who was later appointed to the Constitutional Court, gave them permission to proceed with the class action and ordered the provincial government to provide the Legal Resources Centre with all its records of grant beneficiaries eligible for class membership. For reasons best known to its managers, the provincial government appealed against the judgment. In a landmark judgment handed down later in 2001, the Supreme Court of Appeal upheld the Froneman judgment, confirming the use of class actions in South Africa to combat infringements of constitutional rights. Among other things, the Supreme Court of Appeal used the legal rules utilized in the United States for deciding whether the group in question had been adequately defined, thereby effectively ruling that those rules would apply in South Africa as well. These state that one or more members of a class may initiate legal action on behalf of all other members if the class is so large that it is impractical for all its members to undertake joint legal action. There are questions of law or fact common to the class. The claims or defence of the representative parties are typical, or the claims or defence of the class are similar, and the representative parties would fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class. These four requirements are commonly known as numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy of representation. However, the Supreme Court of Appeal reiterated that this could only be done where a constitutional right had been infringed or threatened. The Eastern Cape government also collected the sharp edge of the appeal court's tongue, referring to its sustained efforts to oppose a class action, the judgment stated, "All this speaks of a contempt for people and process that does not befit an organ of government under our constitutional dispensation. It is not the function of the courts to criticize government's decisions in the area of social policy." But when an organ of government invokes legal processes to impede the rightful claims of its citizens, it not only defies the Constitution, which commands all organs of state to be loyal to the Constitution and requires that public administration be conducted on the basis that people's needs must be responded to. It also misuses the mechanisms of the law, which it is the responsibility of the courts to safeguard. The province's approach to these proceedings was contradictory, cynical, expedient, and obstructionist. It conducted the case as though it was at war with its own citizens, the more shamefully because those it was combating were, in terms of the secular hierarchies and affluence and power, the least in its sphere. We were told, in extenuation, that unentitled claimants were costing the province 65 million rand a month. That misses the point, which is the cost the province's remedy exacted in human suffering on those who are entitled to benefits. But back to our story. The Inclusa judgment seemed to open the door for class action claims by bread distributors as well as consumers, as each consumer had a relatively modest claim for the overpriced bread bought. A class action seemed the ideal vehicle for consolidating action on behalf of consumers on the grounds that the two human rights underwritten in the Constitution, sufficient food for everyone and basic nutrition for children, had been infringed or threatened. In the case of the distributors, it was a lot more difficult to discern a human rights infringement. While Section 22 of the Bill of Rights states that every citizen has the right to choose their trade, occupation, or profession freely, it is a bit of a stretch to mould this right into a foundation for a damages action based on loss of income due to cartel activities of which the bread distributors' businesses were victim. Essentially, a class action occurs when a party or parties embark on legal action, typically claiming damages, on behalf of a larger group of people whom they claim to represent. Other members do not play a role in initiating the case and do not appear in court, but are given an opportunity to indicate whether or not they would like to belong to the class in question. If the class action succeeds, all members are meant to benefit. Class actions are most useful when the allegations involve a large number of people who have been wronged in the same way. Instead of each injured person bringing their own lawsuit, the class action allows the claims of all class members to be resolved in a single proceeding. Class actions developed in the United States and are still most common in that country, adding to its reputation for excessive litigation. But they are spreading to other countries too, notably to allow consumer organizations to bring claims on behalf of consumers. As noted earlier, the Constitution has opened the door to class actions in South Africa, and South African judges have thus far drawn on the American approach in developing local jurisprudence. In American class actions, at least one of the parties, whether the plaintiffs or defendants, are collectively represented by a member or members of the group in question. Those members, known as the named plaintiffs or defendants, are present in court and litigate on behalf of themselves and the absent class members. Class actions are initiated by filing a proposed or putative action in terms of which the potential claimants seek to represent themselves and other parties To proceed, they must satisfy certain requirements. Until this happens, the class is referred to as a putative or potential class, and its members as putative or potential class members. First, potential claimants must define the class they seek to represent. This must be precise enough to allow the court to determine who belongs to the class and who doesn't. Second, they must be members of the class they seek to represent and must have relevant standing to assert their claims. Third, classes must meet four criteria spelt out in the American legal rules referred to earlier, widely referred to as numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy of representation. Potential class actions must also satisfy at least one of the following three requirements. Separate actions could establish inconsistent standards of conduct or substantially impair other class members' ability to protect their interests. Joint relief would be appropriate because the party opposing the class acted on grounds that are generally applicable to the entire class, and common issues of law and fact predominate over individual issues, and a class action is the best way of resolving the plaintiff's claims. In actions for monetary damages, this is regarded as the most important requirement. Courts determine before a trial whether the potential claimants meet these requirements. If they do, the class is certified and the class action proceeds. If they don't, the action fails and claimants are left to pursue their claims individually. Today, most American class actions are initiated on an opt-out rather than an opt-in basis. This means that all putative class members are assumed to be part of a class unless they give notice that they wish to opt out. By contrast, opt-in class actions mean that all putative class members who wish to be regarded as members and benefit from any awards need to give notice that they wish to opt in. If the court certifies the class in question, it will set specific deadlines for the representative plaintiffs to notify absent class members and for absent class members to decide whether they wish to opt in or out. The notices and their intended distribution have to be approved by the court. Notice is usually given either by mail, if this is practicable, or via the media. Given all this, it was clear that the cases for bread consumers and distributors differed in several important respects and required different approaches. Specifically, given the differences in extent of the two proposed classes, the opt-in model seemed more appropriate in one instance and the opt-out model in the other. For these and other reasons, Mukadam and his team decided to pursue these matters separately, with one application brought on behalf of the distributors and the other on behalf of the consumers. Acting Judge Van Zyl heard and pronounced on both at the same time. The consumer case was brought by 9 applicants: the Children's Resource Center Trust, the Black Sash Trust, COSATU, the National Consumer Forum, and 5 individuals representing a spread of bread consumers. The first applicants were represented by its coordinator, Marcus Chinasami Solomon. The respondents were the 3 bread producers found guilty of collusive practices, namely Pioneer Foods, Tiger Consumer Brands, and Premier Foods. In a founding affidavit, Solomon said the Competition Commission had instituted an investigation into the conduct of the respondents. It found they had engaged in restricted horizontal practice by acting in concert to fix the selling price of bread in the Western Cape and dividing markets. This unlawful conduct had breached the rights of both bread consumers and bread distributors. The applicants intended to institute a class action against the respondents on behalf of the consumers for compensation and related relief. To this end, they would seek leave to represent the class, as well as ancillary relief about the procedures to be followed. On the suitability of class actions, the affidavit said affected consumers constituted a large number of people running into millions. Given their socioeconomic circumstances and the costs of litigation, most did not have the financial means and resources to embark on litigation. Also, individual claims were too small in value to justify individual action, but taken together amounted to a large amount of money. The respondents were the three largest bread producers who dominated the market in the Western Cape. Together, they produced bread that was bought and consumed by millions of consumers on a daily basis. Every consumer who had bought their products during the period in question had suffered damages as a result of the unlawful price fixing and other prohibited practices. Relief sought in the class action would take two forms. First, calculating the damages that consumers had suffered would require access to the respondents' records and accounts. As a result, the applicants would seek access to the accounts in order to establish the damages suffered by the class. Second, the damages suffered by each bread consumer were very small. If global damages were awarded, the cost of distributing it to consumers would be prohibitive. Moreover, it would be difficult or impossible to establish precisely how much of the respondents' bread each consumer had bought during the period in question. For this reason, the applicants would seek an order that would require the respondents to pay the unlawful overcharge into a trust or trusts to be established for the benefit of consumers. On the appropriateness of a class action, the affidavit argued that millions of bread consumers in the Western Cape had been affected by the respondents' unlawful conduct, and that a class action was the only practical and efficient way of resolving their claims. The affidavit defined the proposed class as consisting of all consumers of bread in the Western Cape who were affected by the unlawful conduct of the respondents. For practical purposes, it said, this virtually amounted to the public at large in the Western Cape. This later led to a moment of dry humour in the courtroom when acting Judge Van Sale asked counsel for applicants whether he should recuse himself, as in terms of this definition, he was also a putative member of the class in question. On the issue of class membership, the affidavit said it was not practical or in the interests of justice to require that individual consumers opt into the class action. The class was very large, the individual claims were very small, and many members of the class did not have the knowledge of their rights and access to the information and advice that would enable them to make the decision to opt into the class. Under these circumstances, the consumers should be given the option to opt out of the class. Proposed steps to publicize giving consumers notice of the class action included notices in 5 newspapers in several languages and broadcasts on 5 radio stations, again in several languages. Moreover, the court should order the respondents to place sticky labels on all of their products, advising consumers of the class action. On the issue of leave to represent the class, the affidavit said the Constitution provided for class actions if a right in the Bill of Rights had been infringed or threatened. In this instance, the applicants would indeed allege that rights in the Bill of Rights had been infringed. Bread was a staple diet of many South Africans. A large number of South Africans, up to 50%, lived in poverty. For such people, a small increase in the bread price, which they paid on a daily basis, could have a material impact on their ability to obtain sufficient food for themselves and their families. The Constitution provided that everyone had the right to access to sufficient food, and also that every child had the right to basic nutrition. This placed a negative obligation on persons such as the respondents to desist from preventing or impairing the right of access to sufficient food, and children's rights to basic nutrition. On the issue of class representation, the CRC had a direct interest in the matter and was a suitable person to represent the class. It had been established 27 years previously with the aim of assisting children to participate in educational, health, and nutritional projects. In the course of its work, it had found that bread constituted an essential part of the diet of children, and in some instances, the primary source of their diet. In September 2002, the centre had begun to engage the national government on the issue of increasing poverty and the high rate of malnutrition among children. Research had shown that malnutrition remained a major problem. Stunting through malnutrition affected one in every five children and is known to have a significant and adverse impact on the physical and emotional development of children, as well as their scholastic performance. The centre had become particularly concerned when it became known that the respondents had colluded in the fixing of the bread price. It believed that such conduct on the part of the respondents had directly and substantially contributed to bread becoming less accessible to children. The centre had no interest of its own in the class action beyond the public interest goals which it sought to promote. Similar arguments were offered in respect of the other applicants. Lastly, the affidavit argued that the applicants' attorneys and counsel were suitably qualified and experienced to represent the class. The applicants initially restricted their claims to the Western Cape, as they believed claims elsewhere would fall outside the jurisdiction of the Western Cape High Court, and similar applications would need to be brought in Gauteng. When, in the course of the court hearing, it emerged that this was unnecessary, they extended the scope of the claim to the entire country. The application for a class action on behalf of the bread distributors was launched by Mukadam, described as a bread distributor based in Elsie's River in the Western Cape. WEM Distributors, CC, a bread distributing company based in Wellington, and Abdul Karim Ibrahim, a bread distributor based in Belhar. In this instance, the applicants sought to institute a class action against the respondents on behalf of about 100 bread distributors in the Western Cape. In a founding affidavit, Mukadam argued that distributors had suffered substantial damages. Many had been forced to close their businesses and others faced sequestration. Given this, many could not afford individual litigation, and a class action was therefore the only effective means of obtaining effective relief. While largely replicating the consumer application, this application differed from it in two major ways. First, it proposed the establishment of an opt-in class. Unlike consumers, the applicants argued, the class of distributors was relatively small and easily identifiable from the records held by the respondents. All distributors would be given proper and adequate notice and an opportunity to opt into the class. Once respondents' records had been accessed, damages could be easily calculated. Notices would be placed in several newspapers and broadcast on several radio stations. Moreover, the respondents should be ordered to send written notices to all distributors by prepaid registered post. Second, as regards the issue of constitutional rights, the applicants argued that distributors were also directly affected by the respondents' conduct that had impaired the right of access to sufficient food and children's rights to basic nutrition. It also infringed their right to freely choose their trade, occupation, and profession, provided for in Section 22 of the Constitution. As noted previously, Acting Judge Van Sail was obliged to hear argument about all this as a matter of urgency, which he did over 2 days in between all the other cases on his roll. He also had to prepare an order within a few days in order to prevent the alleged lapse of the proposed claims before summons could be issued pursuant to the certification of a class action. He did so via a 10,000-word judgment, which must have kept him up into the early hours. Addressing the issue of class actions in general prior to addressing the two applications, Acting Judge von Sail noted the 1996 Constitution provided for class action when rights in the Bill of Rights had been infringed or threatened. In Inclusa versus the Department of Welfare, Judge Froneman had found that practical difficulties that could arise in class actions could not justify their denial when the Constitution made specific provision for this. Judge Froneman had dealt with the practical objections to the class actions, including the objection that the courts would be engulfed by interfering busybodies rushing to court for spurious reasons, the so-called floodgates argument, and the objection that the common interest of applicants and those they sought to represent would often be broad and vague, the so-called classification difficulty. In respect to the floodgates objection, Judge Froneman had noted that unjustified litigation could be curtailed by requiring that leave must be sought from the High Court to proceed on a representative basis prior to actually embarking on that road. The classification problem could be addressed in the same way at a preliminary stage. The determination of a common interest sufficient to justify class, group, or representative representation would depend on the facts of each case. The common interest had to relate to the alleged infringement of a fundamental right as required by the Constitution. The Inclusa judgment had been upheld on appeal, dealing with the respondent's argument that the class in the matter was not adequately defined. The Supreme Court of Appeal had confirmed that a class action had to comply with the following criteria. The class should be so numerous that joinder of all its members was impracticable. There were questions of law and fact common to the class. The claims of the applicants representing the class were typical of the claims of the rest, and the applicants would fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class. The Supreme Court of Appeal had concluded that the requisites for a class action were present. The provisions for class actions in the Constitution only applied directly to infringements of or threats to rights in the Bill of Rights. However, in a paper published in 1998, the South African Law Commission had concluded that the scope of class actions should be broadened to non-Bill of Rights cases as well. Moreover, while the Inclusa matter had only involved a Bill of Rights issue, the judgment indicated that a class action not limited to Bill of Rights cases should be available in South African law. Like Judge Froneman, the Law Commission report had recommended that a preliminary application should be brought, requesting leave to institute a class action and to ask for directions in respect of procedure. This would prevent potential abuse of the process, shield defendants against unreasonable burden of complex and costly litigation, protect the interest of absent class members. The Law Commission had also spelled out criteria for judging applications for the certification of class actions. These were that the application should involve an identifiable class of people, that a common cause of action was disclosed, that there were issues of fact and law which were common to the class, a suitable representative was available, the interests of justice would be served, and a class action was the most appropriate way of dealing with the matter in question. Acting Judge von Sail said he would follow the Law Commission's recommendations in dealing with both applications. In the event the consumer case fell foul of two of these criteria, class identification and a common cause of action. On the first score, Acting Judge von Sail noted that the applicants had described the class as all consumers who were prejudicially affected by bread prices as a result of the respondents' unlawful actions. This included corporate entities such as companies and operating hotels, restaurants and the like, as well as millions of others whose constitutional rights had not by any stretch of the imagination been threatened or infringed. This raised the issue of whether class action should be available in non-Bill of Rights matters. He would accept that the applicants could bring a class action for damages and that the description of the broad class of consumers was sufficient to identify those who might have a potential claim. However, the applicants had failed to identify the period or periods during which the damages claim had arisen. Therefore, as in the case of the narrower class, the parameters of the intended damages action were not sufficiently defined so as to identify all the people who would be bound by the result. As regards a cause of action, the applicants had asked the court to order the respondents to provide accounts for the excessive charges, order the establishment of a trust or trusts that would receive the damages and use them to promote the interests of the class, and order the respondents to pay damages to the trust. However, the respondents did not supply bread directly to consumers, but to the retail trade and bread distributors, and were therefore not contractually obliged to render accounts to consumers. The respondents also did not have a statutory duty to do so, and there was no fiduciary relationship between the respondents and consumers that obliged the former to account to the latter. Accordingly, the consumers had no right to demand that the respondents render such accounts to them and for such accounts to be debited. In light of the applicant's failure to sufficiently identify the class they wish to represent and to disclose a cause of action, the consumer application stood to be dismissed. Given that the applicants intended to promote the advancement of constitutional justice, he would not order them to pay the respondents' costs. As regards the distributor application, Acting Judge Fonsale noted that Section 22 of the Constitution protected individuals rather than juristic persons. It followed that a juristic entity, such as the second applicant, and many other prospective plaintiffs could not claim protection under Section 22. Again, he would accept that the applicants were able in principle to represent a class in non-Bill of Rights matters. However, he was not convinced that the issues of fact and law to be decided in respect of the various distributors and the respondents with whom they had dealt were such that the matter should be dealt with as a class action against the three respondents. For these reasons, the applicants had not made out a case for leave to institute a class action on behalf of the distributors. In this instance, Acting Judge Fonsale ordered the applicants to pay the respondents' costs. It was at this point that Accountability Now was approached in relation to this matter. It seemed ripe for appeal. However, the cartel members had argued that there was a potential conflict of interest between the consumers and distributors, especially if the distributors had simply recovered their reduced markups from consumers. Rather than find themselves embroiled in arguments about the alleged conflict, the attorneys in the matter wisely decided to seek separate legal representation for the consumers and distributors. Charles Abrams, the senior attorney involved in the case, who was also Terry Crawford Brown's attorney in the arms deal case, phoned me on a Saturday afternoon. "Paul, this case needs the Hoffman touch," he pleaded. "We've come unstuck so far, but the justice of the cause is very important to us, as we want to start a silicosis class action for retired miners." I wondered aloud whether any human rights of bread distributors had been infringed, but Charles was adamant that Section 22 was open to an interpretation that would assist the certification of the class. Cautiously, I said, "Send us the judgment so that we can consider the prospects of success on appeal. We will find a firm of attorneys willing to act on contingency in the matter, and you will get a brief from them," Charles replied, with audible relief. Soon, The judgment arrived from Terence Matsdorf, the senior attorney in the Cape Town branch of the Johannesburg firm Knowles, Hussein and Lindsay. I was pleased to be working with him, as we'd often collaborated during my years at the Cape Bar. Chris Schoen, a co-director of Accountability Now and an ace internet researcher, showed interest in being my junior in the matter. The first task at hand was to see what could be done to get permission from Acting Judge Van Sail to appeal against his decision. This involves an application for leave to appeal that would need to demonstrate that another court might come to a different conclusion. Fortunately for us, the team representing the bread consumers, who were briefed by Charles from the get-go, were in the same boat as us and had definite ideas about how to persuade Acting Judge Van Sail to grant leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal in Bloemfontein. Jeff Budlander, SC of the Cape Bar, led the charge in the application for leave to appeal on behalf of the consumers, while Chris Schoen, Peter Hazel, SC, and I appeared for the distributors, duly briefed by Terence Matsdorf. It was clear to us that it would take a lot of effort to persuade the acting judge to accept that another court might come to a different conclusion. He had obviously put considerable research and thought into the judgment, had dealt with the arguments raised in a very thorough way, and his reasoning was lucid and persuasive. In part because the acting appointment of the judge had ended, and in part because of the difficulty of assembling such a large number of counsel, the argument in the application for leave to appeal was heard on a Saturday. To the chagrin of rugby fans in court, the argument dragged on well past the scheduled time for the kickoff of an enticing Super Rugby fixture. The judge wanted to be sure that he had a full grasp on the criticisms of his judgment offered by the applicants and of the defences of his reasoning put up by the respondents, whose counsel doggedly defended the reasoning adopted by the court. After considering the arguments for some weeks, the verdict was delivered. Leave to appeal was refused. The acting judge was not budging, and did not believe that there was a reasonable possibility of any other court coming to a different conclusion.